Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay, bisexual, or trans person. So if you have any comments you'd like to make during the broadcast, you can write to me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkaye@aol.com. Over the years, I did many podcasts, and one of the best podcasts every time I did it was with my guest tonight, who's an amazing woman who has inspired me for many years since I've seen her and known her on the phone and actually had the chance to meet her in person. And she has inspired so many of our members. She's a woman who's an author, a life coach, and has helped so many women with her coaching to get their life on board in the direction they need to go in. So I am very honored to have my dear friend, Suzette Vernon. Good evening, Suzette.
Hi, Bonnie.
It's such a wonderful thing to hear your voice again.
I know it has been too long.
I know. You know, like I say, when I kind of retired last year.
Yeah, kind of retired.
I felt good. kind of retired. You know, still running my support group. But I stopped the radio shows, and I really felt I needed a break because, you know, it was 8 years that I was doing them every week. And after a while, you just need a break. And I was planning to break forever, but so many people have written into me about the show and how it's helped them, hearing speakers like you, meeting, you know, people along the way who are like them, going through the same struggles. So I felt it's only an hour a week, and this way I can get to talk to wonderful people like you again, which, like I say, it's the best part of this show. And so thank you so much for doing this at the beginning of the journey. We've had a couple of our wonderful women who've gone through this talk to others, because that's what this situation is about. It's about sharing experience while you're going through it. You know, I now tell people this whole network is about discovery to recovery. So from the time you discover you're in this situation and up to the time you recover. And everybody has different recovery periods. You can't put a number on how long it's going to take you to recover. But certainly this is a unique situation, even though millions share it. But it's unique in the sense that the recovery is a longer period of time for so many reasons. And you can certainly address that, can't you?
Oh, indeed, yes. It is a different animal. You know, because I had somebody tell me, I never forget, after my second divorce from this gentleman, my ex-husband, I went to a divorce support group, and I was explaining to them what had happened. And one lady said, oh, that's no different than being cheated on. And I looked at her like she had five heads. Like, how in the world can you compare being married to a gay man as the same as getting cheated on? I couldn't understand it.
I don't think people understand this. And in fact, I've even had people tell me, believe it or not, that it's better to be cheated on with another guy than with a woman. And that's how they feel.
Wow. Well, I know that when she said to me, I knew I wasn't going back. Yeah, I knew I wasn't going back to that support group after she said that, because I felt like she had minimalized what I was sharing with them with eyes, you know, tears coming down my face, and I'm being vulnerable. And she turns right around and says, oh, that's the same. That's so different than us. That's just like getting cheated on. So anyway, yeah, it is more, it's more devastating.
What is your opinion of why it's so different? Maybe you can tell women that.
Well, I think the reason why, at least for me, if it's another woman, you all have the same plumbing. You have the same thing. So you can kind of, not that it makes it any better, but you can kind of understand that a little bit. But when there's somebody that, no matter how much more woman you become, no matter how much of a great woman, how mature, how whatever you become, he's going to be more and more turned off by you the more woman you become. Then there's no, where else can you go? There is a whole different animal.
I think really why I think the most important reason why it's so different, and I always say there are two different kinds of women that are in this situation. Those women who have horrible marriages that are mentally, emotionally abusive, and those women who think they have a wonderful marriage and they're so blindsided by this because they can't understand how a loving, wonderful husband could all of a sudden one day wake up and say, I'm gay. But for the women who have been mentally abused, which I believe probably about 85-90% of all of us, but, you know, we're in that group, it's not just that we're being cheated on. It's that we've been really debased and we've been put down. We've been made to feel worthless. We've been sexually rejected. Our self-esteem is down in the ground from, you know, can't even stand up. That it was just a bad marriage. And people do have bad marriages all the time, you know, that are straight, not because it's a straight gay situation. But if you just had problems in a marriage and it wasn't working out, okay, you can move on. But these guys just don't move on. They just leave you in a state of devastation where they've taken everything from you, every feeling of self-worth that you may have had going into this marriage, you know, made you feel like you can't trust anybody again, taken away any kind of love that you've given. It's been humiliating in many cases because you're so criticized by your husband who's constantly finding what's wrong with you because he doesn't want to deal with what's wrong with him. So that's where I think it's even different. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think it's arguable that some of these women who've been in, you know, heterosexual relationships could say, well, my ex did the same thing to me. I think what it is, at least like I was saying, for me, is that there, no matter, you're being rejected as a woman. Whereas if the person, if he cheats on you with another woman, that's another woman. There, you know, there's a certain, you can be attractive. You, it's attraction thing. He can be sexually attracted to women. But when a man is not sexually attracted to you, that means he can't be emotionally, physically, he can't want you in the way that a man would naturally want a woman. And that takes it to a whole deeper level. That's the rejection of your very femininity, your very womanliness, your very gender.
I like to call it killing your feminine spirit. Yeah,
exactly.
And that's what it does to you. But I think even in a straight marriage where you have two straight people, even if he's cheating on you, it's not like all along he's been sexually rejecting you. And I think that's where the difference is. You know, at least you understand what passion is. At least you understand what foreplay is. At least you understand what making love is, as opposed to somebody having sex with you because they have to. And I think that's a lot of times what we're feeling with these guys. Yeah, they'll do it with you, quote unquote, do. But when they do it with you, it's not like they really want to do it with you. It's like they're doing you a favor.
Yeah, and it's when they're turned off by the very thing that heterosexual men are. Like, I remember when you made a list of certain things and we were talking about it, how he's even turned off by the odor that you give off that's supposed to be sexually arousing to him is distasteful. So that's why I said it crucifies you on a different level. The very things about your femininity, the very odors, the very sweat, the very energy you give off as a woman is repulsive to him.
Exactly. And even those men who say, I can't kiss you because you have bad breath. I mean, how humiliating is that? And it's not like you can take a mouthwash and it's going to get any better. You're still going to say it's bad, or that you have body odor, you smell. So once the man you love and trust your life with starts telling you these things, how are you supposed to feel about yourself? You just stop asking because it's so personal. I think sex is very personal between two people, right? I mean, I think it's the greatest way people can express their love for each other. And you're taking that love and humiliating the woman, telling her, I don't want you because there's something wrong with you.
Exactly.
And it has nothing to do with you. So that's
nothing
where I think it's different for couples. They don't go through that same kind of humiliation. Yeah, a guy will go and maybe cheat on his wife or, you know, he'll go find a girlfriend. I'm not saying any of that's any, you know, is any good, but I'm just saying it's a different dynamic. At least you've been with him. You know, when a straight man wants you and he marries you, he's really into you. I mean, he does want you. When a gay man marries you, he's still not into you, and he still doesn't really want you.
Yeah.
And just like you're
and
thinking,
you can
okay,
never
women
get
into. Exactly. Like women spend all this time fantasizing about how I'm going to make my husband want to have sex with me, and he's sitting there fantasizing as much, how am I going to get out of having sex with her? It's like,
exactly.
How much time is wasted with both people thinking the opposite things? And I think that's where
and
a big
I've
difference
been through
is.
It, too. And so have you, Bonnie. We've been through that, and I'm sure some of the listeners have, too, where no matter what you do, it doesn't matter. Because at first, in the beginning, when he would say things like, it's because, you know, it's because of this about you. It's because you're insecure. It's because you're this. It's because you don't smell right. It's because all these things. In the beginning, when you first hear them, you can kind of recoil and be okay. But after you've heard that over and over, and even if he doesn't say it, the way his body tenses up, it got so bad with my ex that I started saying to him, he would shake if he thought I was coming in for a kiss. He would convulse like a person, like I would if one of my girlfriends came at me sexual. Like, whoa,
exactly.
What's up with that?
Exactly.
And he would do that, and he was my husband, and he would do it, and it got so bad, I said to him, that's all right, baby, don't worry, I'm not going to try to kiss you. You don't have to tense up. You don't have to be nervous. I'm not going to kiss you. I mean, and that was the part. It's like it was not even conscious he could not unless he prepared himself mentally, or unless it was on his own terms and he was in control, he could not respond if I was the initiator. It turned him off.
Exactly. And you know what women have to go through, suffering when their husbands are telling them, well, you're a nymphomaniac, or there's something wrong with you, or, you know, why are you after sex all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never
forget
when I married my ex. I remember when I married my ex-husband, my gay ex-husband. And we were in our 20s. I mean, it's not like we were old, and I had been married before. I've been down the road. I mean, I didn't know everything, but I knew a lot. And we were married, and, you know, I thought at least in our mid-20s, you know, that we would have sex like twice a week is not asking too much. But when we wanted to have it with him, he would say, why are you always thinking about sex? Why are you always talking about sex? And I said, well, we're just, you know, newly together, newly married. That's what married people do. You know, that's part of the relationship. And, you know, he would knock me down by saying, you must be a nymphomaniac. He said, I've never seen people want sex like you do. And that was the beginning of the deterioration of my feelings as far as who I was as a woman. You know,
I don't know if I told you this one. I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, I didn't know if I had told you this. When you said that about the nymphomaniac, it reminded me of when he and I first got married the first time. I remember, you know, I had grown up in church, so you were taught to wait until you got married. Now, I didn't wait until I got married, but you still were taught that, you know, if you did it outside of marriage, it was fornication, la-di-di-la-di-da. So for me, once I got married, it was like, yay, I can finally have sex without guilt. You know, without having to ask God to forgive me for the slip up. And so I never forget, we got married, and I remember our first night together. It was awkward, but I told myself it would get better. You know, he and I had never slept with each other, though I had had sex before. So I was like, you know, it's awkward. We haven't slept together. We decided we weren't going to do that till we got married, la, 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 la. And I never forget, it was awkward and it felt odd and strange. But I told myself that and I went to sleep. And I remember the next morning, you know how if you're on your honeymoon, the next morning you start touching each other and hoping you're going to do it again, right? And I remember I was laying beside him. His back was to me. And I was kissing his neck, kissing his shoulder, rubbing his back. And he slowly rolled over, and I thought, oh, we get ready to get it on. Can I tell you, he slowly rolled over, and he had the most disapproving look I have ever witnessed in my life from a man. He looked at me with absolute hate in his eyes, and he said, I told you this was not Cinderella. This wasn't no fairy tale. We weren't going to be having sex every single day. And roll back over slowly again. I was devastated.
Terrible.
Devastated. And I was too far away from home to get back to Raleigh. I was about 7-8 hours away. And we were in a hotel room. And I remember it hurt me so bad. I got up, got my clothes on, didn't know my way around the city, but I got in the car and I drove to an empty parking lot and cried for hours.
So terrible. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet he couldn't care less, right?
Mm-mm. He acted like nothing had happened. He acted like when
and
I got back
happen?
To the hotel room, he didn't do that again while we were at the honeymoon, you know, on honeymoon. But the hurt still lingered. It still lingered. And then he found other more subtle ways of rejecting me.
Did he criticize you much?
It was always kind of subtle. It was very kind of getaway closer, kind of, you know, almost like, it almost felt like you were being gummed to death by a toothless lion, his criticism, where he'd be like, oh, baby, you know what? You are absolutely sexy, and I would just love to have sex with you, but da, 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 da. Or, no, it's not you. It's not you at all. I'm just not feeling well. I'm coming down with something, and I don't want to give you my code. You know, it was things like that. Or he would actually, we used to work together at home. And I remember, because we worked together, I would get up in the morning, shower, you know, get before I put my clothes on. He would have the same things on all day long. And he already had a condition. He had something similar to MS, and he used to be wheelchair bound. And I never forget, he used to be in that wheelchair wearing the same Depends all day long till he smelled so bad. And after a while, I realized the reason he did it was because he wanted me to be turned off. So I didn't want him. That was the link he was willing to go through. He was willing to use his illness as an excuse. And some people might say, well, Suzette, he was sick, he was ill. But here's the thing. When one of his buddies called him, he would take a bath and everything, put on cologne to go meet with his buddy friends. But he did not extend to me the same courtesy of, I'm in the house with him all day, and he smells like a urinal.
Well, I'm sure he was purposely doing that, Suzette.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely.
So you wouldn't want to be with him, right?
Exactly. And, of course, he never would come right out and say it. But that was why. He didn't want me to even think about having sex.
I know my ex-husband, he was very clean about himself. But around me, he would never wear cologne. He wouldn't shave. You know, he'd take a shower. But he wouldn't make himself as unappealing as possible so that hopefully I wouldn't want to do anything with him. But I always knew when he was going out to do something, because he would put on cologne, he would do his hair, he would look, you know, meticulous when he went out.
They read the same book.
Right?
It must be a manual, Bonnie, it must be a manual.
How to get your wife to not want to have sex with you when she desperately wants to, right?
Exactly.
Although mine had a lot of headaches, backaches, toothaches. I can't begin to tell you how many aches he had that stopped him from wanting to have sex with me. And then I always said, you know, with us, it was like the orgasm bank. You know, he felt like if he had an orgasm and I didn't, well, he owes me one. And if I didn't, he did. If I had one, he didn't have one, he'd say, well, that's all right, you'll owe me one. I mean, I always felt like I'm banking with him. You know, it was just never a natural thing with beauty, you know, like I've had for the past 26 years with my soulmate, you know, where you're anxious to be with someone, when you love to make them happy, when you're being happy, when you being satisfied is making them happier instead of more miserable, you know, where you can talk and say things and just, you know, it's just so different. And for those women who have been sitting for 30, 40 years in these marriages and really don't have experience otherwise, you know, my heart goes out to them that their whole femininity and feminine spirit was stolen away from them. Don't you feel like that?
Yeah, and I'm like, don't let that man take the suppleness of your aliveness from you, because that's what he's doing. It's like you're getting drier and drier. I used to feel so old with him, with my ex-husband. I felt so old, which is completely different. I just turned 60 December, Bonnie. So I'm not a young chick no more. But the beautiful thing about it is, I turned 60, but I felt younger, and I don't give all the credit to my wonderful husband, my now husband, but living with somebody that loves you, the whole energy in the house the whole energy, the whole musicality, the rhythm that we have, that the ebb and flow of our togetherness is so more, it's more exciting even when you're not touching each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gives life, it gives life to you in ways you didn't even know you were missing it when you were married to somebody gay, until you experience really being loved by somebody. You go, oh my God, I feel younger. I feel more alive. I just do.
Yeah, and that's very true, because I spent most of my marriage, most of it, I would say, being a private detective, investigating all the things my ex-husband was doing, because I didn't believe that he could be that way towards me for no reason at all. And once I had my mm-hmm. suspicions, and, you know, once I would say, caught him, you know, maybe not walked in on him, but I knew the truth. And, of course, he would say it was a one-time thing, it was a slip-up, it will never happen again. But, you know, once the trust is gone on that, and you see their behaviors are changing, you know, they get, mm-hmm. you know, they in the beginning they try to keep it in so you don't see anything. But it's very hard
yeah.
to keep pretending something, you know, that you're someone that you're not, you know, and keep
exactly.
living a lie. I mean, that's the worst part. They have to
mm-hmm.
keep track of all their lies. And then you keep
yeah,
wanting to believe it's
yeah.
never going to happen again, or that they're, you know, telling you the truth, because you don't want to leave your marriage and you have children and it's hard to break up. And it just, you know, it just gets worse. It never gets better, right?
No, it doesn't. I think the reason the resentment builds up is like nobody wants to pretend to be somebody they're not.
Exactly. And that's how they have to play that game while they're married to you. And so for
mm-hmm.
people who don't know you, you know, we have new people in our support group who haven't had much experience, you know, listening to you, because it's been a while. I'd just like you to reassure them, because you did mention you were married twice, on how that happened.
Yeah, I know new listeners. I married the same gay man twice. Yes. Not one of my finer moments.
mm-hmm.
Not something I'm proud of, but one of the things that was very freeing to me, Bonnie, even when I was on a guest earlier, was you were like, why would it have happened? Because I grew up in such a rigid, legalistic home
mm-hmm.
where sex was taboo. We didn't talk about it. My parents were very uncomfortable with it, and every sermon you heard was fire and brimstone and death and hell and, you know, making God mad. So it's like, why wouldn't I have married somebody that would not have been sexually attracted to me? Subliminally, not that I did it overtly, but subliminally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very ignorant. I was very naive. I was raised on Disney and soap operas like The Guiding Light and The Edge of Night. And so, you know, that and naivety don't mix very well. And so I was easily fooled. I didn't know how to trust my instincts. I felt like something was off, but because I couldn't prove it and I didn't have enough skill and know-how and understanding about men and how they represent as sexual beings
mm-hmm.
and how they are when they're in love, I had no point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
And so he used Bible and scriptures and twisted them to keep me off balance.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and so, and the second time around, I think because I didn't get wiser, I was so glad to get away, I
mm-hmm.
still didn't educate myself about men. I didn't educate myself. And because we have a son, he gained access to me again. And he said the words that a lot of good Christian women would love to hear. And those words are, I promised God if he gave me another chance, I wouldn't mess it up with you again. I'm delivered of it. It's over. I asked God to please give you back to me. I ate it, hook, line, and sinker.
And I think
it.
That's so easy to do. I mean, I could never criticize anybody for that, because when you love someone or you have children with someone and the thing that was in your way was his homosexuality, and then he says to you, well, I took care of it. I mean, you know, back in those days, we didn't have computers. We didn't have the know-how that people have today. There was no place to check this out, you know. So we assume God could take care of every problem. That's how your church raises you, right? So
that's right.
Would you ever use to doubt that he's changed? So you wanted to take another check, but you had a son.
Mm-hmm. And they also preached it. I mean, if people came in or represented with homosexuality, they thought you could pray the gay away or have hands laid on you and you get delivered. Or if you were effeminate, I knew of a preacher that had men in his church that he claimed had gotten delivered, and he was teaching them how to be men again, how to walk without that sway in their hips, how to be less feminine. I mean, I grew up around that stuff. So it only made sense to me.
There was so much misinformation back then that today, thankfully, I think they're much better. Not totally, because people still believe that some people, that people can change their homosexuality, right?
Yeah, they still believe it. They do.
And I think some of the churches, you know, preach that.
Yeah, and I think the thing that really, it's almost like, not saying that this is true, but my feeling I got is because a lot of it's public knowledge, it's almost become a joke that the minister of music is gay. I mean, in the black church, it's almost like the running joke that the minister of music or the choir director is homosexual. Mm-hmm. But the thing about it is, in many of these churches, the preachers preach against it, like the fire and brimstone preaching against it. And I guess the ministers think, well, if I make it sound bad enough and I preach against it, that's all I need to do. So I'll keep you in my choir because I've already given you the riot act, told you, but I still want you to make my choir sound good. So I still want you to direct my choir and make my choir sound good. So my own due diligence, I've done my work. If I preach against it, I've done what I'm supposed to do. What you do with what I preach is up to you. But I've already at least preached against it, so that means I'm clear.
Do you think things have changed today since then? Do you think there's any more open? No.
No, I don't. I think a lot of views have gone underground. I think some things have gone underground. But most of the churches that are against homosexuality still are. Now, I think because there's more people who are more progressive in their thinking and more educated, you're having certain churches that are a little bit more gay-friendly, and they advertise as such. But for the most part, my experience with the black church, though, the Pentecostal Baptist black church, though, nope, I don't think it's changed. Nope, I don't. I think it's tolerated because, like I said, you can turn a blind eye to somebody that's making your choir sound good, because a lot of our black are built around good music. So if you can make our choir sound good and you can keep your homosexuality under wraps, I'm cool with it. So, and the way I make sure I keep you under wraps is I'm going to preach against it now. I'm going to tell you what the Bible says according to me, and I'm going to preach against it and make it sound really bad. So that if you were thinking about following through with anybody in this church, guess again.
I think like a lot of people are swayed with the whole religious aspect of this. If you've grown up in a strictly Christian church or a strictly Jewish synagogue, because religious Jews have the same issues as, you know, Christians who are really religious. It's not acceptable to them either. You know, and they have to kind of leave the religion in order to lead an openly gay life. And there's a lot of consequences when it's such a, you know, it's very hard to do. And that's why I say I feel so bad for people who have to keep living these lives of and taking down people with them, because it's not just you who's suffering. It's the woman you marry, promise to love and cherish. And they just don't get that. You know, they think it's okay, the fact that they're supporting their family, that they're working and bringing home money, that that's all they need to do, and it has nothing to do with the whole thing. A marriage can't just survive because somebody's paying the bills, right?
that's true. And sadly, a lot of the deceptiveness is perpetuated because you want to fit in. You know, you want God to love you. You want to, you know, come to church and you know, all that kind of stuff. And you want to be accepted. So it's like, okay, I'm going to try to pray the gay away. And the best thing I can do to maybe, you know, exercise this demon that's making me feel like this is to marry somebody. Then you bring an innocent person into your crazy. And then you find out it's worse than it was before.
Uh-huh.
It's worse. And then she's suffering. And if you have children, they're suffering. So it's a big mess. And I just would prefer people have the freedom to be who they are and own it. Be who they are and own it. And stop pretending to be something else and then terrorizing people's lives.
I agree with you there. I think it's a very disastrous situation and takes a long time for people to get through it. I know I was reading something today from one of the women who posted in our group. I thought it was really interesting. It's telling people to forgive is gaslighting in disguise. And I thought this article was so interesting. It's by someone in England, and it talks about, you know, feeling angry after the situation. So I just want to read a little bit for you and get your feelings about it. It says, I'm not surprised by the plethora of literature recommending forgiveness. If you let go by forgiving, you do not have to hold on to resentment and anger. You know, that's pretty much the line I read a lot of times. And it says, worryingly, the concept floats around in therapy circles and has been widely imparted. A message of forgiveness is necessary for personal growth. Forgiveness echoes indiscriminately to people who have experienced what may be considered minor hurts, as well as those who live with debilitating trauma as a result of someone else's actions. There is a lack of consideration towards detrimental and toxic aspects of forgiveness. The thought of a victim feeling that they have to forgive their perpetrators is something I find uncomfortable, if not sickening. It places a burden of responsibility on those who are hurt. The victim becomes in charge of letting go of the consequences of another person's cruel and selfish actions. For people who have experienced trauma, often there's a legacy of abuse. Harm mostly doesn't happen in an accidental incident that can simply be wished away through a shift in the mindset and positive thinking. Instead, more often than not, there's a cumulative effect. Multiple incidents have become embedded into a person's psyche. Their sense of self, the world, and others is notably altered by the trauma. It impacts how a person navigates relationships, work, leisure life, and may manifest in chronic illness as well as psychological illness. The chronic health conditions, fibromyalgia and rheumatoid arthritis, have, for instance, been linked to childhood trauma and abuse. It's no surprise that trauma is often found in suicide, self-harm, addictions, eating disorders, and a multitude of other physical and mental health difficulties. It has a huge impact. People who have been abused live with the legacy of their abuse. The idea of forgiveness reflects a culture where people who have been abused and blamed for the difficult experience they live as a result of their abuse. There's a toxic culture where victims are not taken seriously. Their emotions are invalidated, and they're told that they are being too sensitive, too poor me, and too dramatic. They're advised to just get on with it, stop carrying a chip on your shoulder, and move on. Forgiveness can be a form of shaming where there's a person's natural feelings of sadness, anger, betrayal, and distrust treated as wrong. We aren't helping people when we place our own way of thinking on their problems. Instead, we can make things worse. As a psychotherapist, I often see how experiences of invalidation and shame that happen in abuse are replayed in completely distinct interactions beyond the abuse, often years later. Forgiveness sends the message that anger is bad. Actually, anger is a natural response which can be necessary and transformative. Anger can spur a person to seek justice and call out the person who has been perpetrated harm. I think back to times when anger has propelled me to take action rather than remaining stuck in the rumination and feeling difficult feelings that I carried. Anger directed my emotions outward energizing me with the fuel that I needed. History has shown us how social movements grow from the field of anger at injustice. It's important to allow a person who's been harmed to decide whether they want to seek justice and call out their perpetrator. And so, I mean, she goes on, you know, I think it's an excellent article. If any of you would like a copy of it, just let me know and I'll send it to you. But I think that's another issue, like after our marriages are over, that we can't be angry. We have to forgive the person. How do you believe about that, Suzette?
Oh, girl. Honestly, I feel like this. I feel like every wound needs a witness. And part of that witness is you having the right to be incensed, angry, upset, I mean, hopping John mad about how you were treated.
Uh-huh.
I think sometimes the reason why we tell our stories over and over and over and over again and rehash it over and over and over and over again is because we feel like we have not been truly heard. And
uh-huh.
if you don't have the right to your anger about it, then you are not giving yourself full range to really experience and be heard by yourself. I think that's the biggest thing. People try to rush you through to forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You need the dignity of your own rage about how you were treated. That is the most undignified thing for people to rush you. It wasn't them that went through it. It was you. They don't have a right to rush you. They don't have a right. And I feel like you need the dignity. You need your own dignity for what you went through. So, yeah, I was mad as hell for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
I was mad. I was upset. I wasn't to the point I was so mad I couldn't function. But, yeah, I was pissed.
Uh-huh.
I was pissed off, and I had to give myself permission. I had to give myself permission to be that because when I tried to be something else, Bonnie, it felt like I was choking. It felt like
uh-huh.
I was depressed, and that's why it would show up in getting sick or show up in all these different things happening in the body because that energy got to go somewhere.
Uh-huh.
That energy is toxic if you don't let it out. Now, the other side of it is after I gave myself the right to my own dignity, to my own rage, to my whatever, once I got that out to my satisfaction, something inside of me said, okay, you've gotten it out now. Now what you gonna do? You know? Because at some point, call it forgiveness, call it releasing, call it whatever you want, at some point. But it's not like tomorrow. You know, it takes time. Your body, just like your body knows, I think your emotions, your soul knows when you have thoroughly released something to the point that you're ready now to move on, just like in grieving. It's the same thing. It's the same cleanse that has to take
uh-huh.
place. Insides know when you're at that point where you say, I can move on now. I'm ready to reclaim my life now. I don't want this pain to define me anymore. I don't want to give you any more power over my life than you had before. But that's something that happens within you. But you have to have the dignity of your own anger about it. You have to.
And I say that forgiveness has to be earned. I don't like to give blind forgiveness. If somebody realizes that you've been hurt, let's say your husband one day, or ex-husband, says, you know what, I look back and I see how I treated you. I look back and I remember how you would cry. I look back now and I say, how did I do that to her? And I'm so sorry. You know. And if he really sincerely, honestly means it, then I can see considering forgiveness. But when somebody still continues after all the horrible years they gave you to keep treating you horribly, I don't think you have to forgive them at all. And I think that I would feel more like a victim if I did.
I think there's a difference in forgiveness and trust. I think there's a difference in forgiveness and now we can walk together as friends or at least as smiling acquaintances again. I think the issue is forgiveness does not mean reconciliation. Forgiveness does not mean now we can be friends. Now, you know, we don't have to sneer at each other. Forgiveness doesn't mean that I'm letting you back. I'm opening my back up again that you can stab me in it. It doesn't mean that I don't owe you trust. Trust has to be earned. But forgiveness disconnects me from you, where what you do no longer is here nor there for me. It doesn't define me. You no longer have power over me. I have cut the chain. You are no longer attached to me emotionally anymore. You no longer control me anymore. Then the forgiveness to me is I release you from owing me anything anymore. I don't need you to be any different than who you are anymore. It's neither here nor there. It is of no consequence to me any longer. That means I have cut, clip. I'm no longer emotionally tied. Now, trust to me is a different thing because I don't trust my ex-husband. I don't trust him as far as I can throw him. But what he does and do, I don't care anymore. I don't care. I'm not tethered to it. My self-esteem is not predicated on it anymore. I no longer need him to be different. I'm not married to him anymore. I no longer need him to be different.
Uh-huh.
I've gone on. So in that sense, I have forgiven him. But do I trust him? Hell no.
Uh-huh.
Hell no. No, I don't think trusting him is necessary.
One of the things I wanted to mention while you're with me tonight is that for those women who feel hopeless as far as a future relationship, I wanted you to give them some words of encouragement.
Oh, baby, let me tell you. Oh, there is love on the other side if you're open to it. You got to be open to it, and you got to be ready, prepared for it. But there is love on the other side, and I just finished celebrating 5 years with my sweet husband, Robert, and I am just as in love with him, just as happy that he's in my life as I was 5 years ago, if not more so, because we've gone through enough marital now to prove some things, to test some things, to test the metal of our relationship. And he is one of the most awesome men that I've ever met. So there is love on the other side, but we have to work on ourselves so that we are an open and willing vessel for it, whether that is love of friendship, love where you can trust men just as friends. For some women, after they've come through being married to a homosexual, it ain't even a matter of romantic love. They don't trust men, period. You know? So just to regain that ability to like men, you know, to actually like them, to actually trust that there are good men in the world and they can be good to you, regardless of whether it's a romantic relationship or not, to even be a good friend, to even be a good, to work with another man, to be have a supervisor that's a male, that you are no longer intimidated by the male species. You have to work through your stuff from this marriage or partnership to somebody gay. And what I did is I worked on that, and it opened up a space for love in my life again. And so there is love on the other side, but it will take work, not just hopefulness, not just fantasy, not staying naive like we were that got us into this thing in the first place, but learning something yourself and learning about men too. Learning what healthy looks like.
And that's something that you can do with people when you're a coach, because a lot of people don't understand coaching and how it relates to therapy. And when you come out of these marriages and you are broken, nobody comes out unscathed for sure. And you're trying to put your life back on track. You need somebody who can be there to guide you along the way. It's almost impossible to do it yourself, or else it takes so much longer. And a lot of people don't know who to go to, and they're looking for therapists, and then they have a bad experience because the therapist doesn't understand the situation, or, you know, they don't want to retract back to their whole past life to move ahead. And I think really that's where coaching comes in, because you can start from where you are and move forward instead of being stuck in the back all the time. Am I right in expressing it that way?
Oh, very right. As a matter of fact, I saw a social media post that said, therapy helps you to function. Coaching helps you to flourish. And so I think that's the difference, because therapy helps you to get to function again, to deal with that pain and that trauma so that you can function, to deal with the past. Because a lot of the reasons why we were attracted to a gay man in the first place was because of unresolved from the past. So the resolving that, and then in coaching, once you've resolved that, can take you forward in your relationship life. It can take you forward. So, yeah.
I think many of the women who go through these marriages had trouble in their past with their families, relationships, abusive relationships before this relationship. I don't think there are many women who go into this with, like, the life going great. And I think that we're all caretakers that marry these men, hoping that even if there are problems, we can take care of it. And usually you become a caretaker when you don't feel that you're worthy in the situation. So I have just found a pattern of women who come from abusive situations into these marriages, not as a whole, but the majority. And so just trying to move ahead and not make the same mistakes, and changing your outlook about relationships, so that you don't have to fall into the same pattern again if you decide that, you know, I'm ready now to meet someone. I know when I was ready to meet someone, I wish I would have had some coaching, because I made some really bad mistakes, you know, because I hadn't cleared up a lot of things about my past marriage, and I was carrying those issues into future relationships, which meant they were going to be doomed anyway. Even, it doesn't mean the man had to be gay. It's just that I didn't feel good enough about myself to have a healthy relationship. And that's what I think one of the wonderful things about coaching is that you can make sure you're ready to have a relationship, know to how to act in your next relationship, and what kind of boundaries you need to set. I think many of us don't have boundaries. Do you find that in your coaching?
Oh, for sure. A lot of women are feel such guilt about setting boundaries. The ones that I coached, it's amazing to me how women feel like they have to explain why they need to set boundaries. They feel guilty. They can be talked out of it because they feel guilty. They feel shame when they set boundaries. That means something in the past went the wrong way, because boundaries are what keeps us safe. And for us to feel bad about setting them, that's an issue that has to be taken care of, because even in a healthy relationship, Bonnie, as you know, even meeting Mr. Right, Mr. Right will become Mr. Wrong if you don't have boundaries.
Exactly.
You gotta have some boundaries. You gotta have some standards that aren't just how tall you want him to be, or what kind of car you want him to drive, or what kind of house you want him to live in. Boundaries and standards are how you want to feel with him, how you want him to respond to you, what kind of person you can be with, that you can be at peace with. A man with capacity and how he wants to treat you, that's boundaries.
And that's one of the things that you as a coach can teach people and be there for them to support them as they're moving ahead in their life. You know, and there's going to be times when you're moving ahead and another day you might be falling back, but at least having somebody there who can throw you that, you know, life ring there. What do they call that? When you throw it into the ocean.
Oh, that the life raft?
No. is a round circle. It's on the cover of my book. And it's like a lifesaver.
Oh, a life preserver.
Life preserver, yep. If you have somebody who can throw you that life preserver while you're sitting there, you know, feeling like you're drowning again, instead of taking extra time, you know, Suzette as a coach can pull you right out of that and move ahead, because it's really hard to always do this by yourself. And in as much as there's not enough support in this whole arena to start with and people who understand it, just having somebody there to be your guide and to show you how to move forward is an amazing opportunity to get better sooner. So, Suzette, how do people reach you if they want to come to you for coaching?
Well, I have maintained the same domain, Bonnie, your coach. No, Coach Suzette. Coach Suzette, www.coachsuzette.com. So I kept that domain. They can find me there. And they can also find me on Facebook. If you search for Your Coach Suzette, you'll find me there. And I also have a podcast that I would love for them to subscribe to.
That would be wonderful.
Enough Factor Podcast. And
I'm sorry, what's it called?
That one, Enough Factor.
Mm-hmm.
Enough Factor Podcast, and that's enoughfactor.podbean.com. podbean.com, and they can find me there as well.
So if you need to reach through that, you know how to do it. And I just want to thank you so much for coming back on the show, Suzette, and I hope you'll come here at least every quarter to inspire women and tell them how to move ahead. Next time we'll go through some of Suzette's books, because she has some wonderful books. I want to mention a few of them while we are on the air.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Yeah, well, let's mention the names of your books in case you want to read them.
Oh, okay. There are three books: The Sound of My Life, The Sound of My Soul, and Protecting Your Emotional G Spot.
Yes, that last one, Protecting Your Emotional G Spot, really has a lot of wonderful messages about getting up and moving ahead. And giving some really great advice about that. I mean, all three books are wonderful. I've read all three of them. And they're inspirational. They're certainly not boring. And there's tips in there on how to keep moving ahead, which is so important while you're going through this. So, Suzette, I want to thank you again. You've always inspired me with your words, and you're so articulate, knowing how to put people's emotions together. And if I had to go through coaching now, you'd be the first coach I would call. So you can reach Suzette. If you can't find her online, then let me know, and I will hook you up with her. So to all of our listeners, we're going to say good night. Suzette, I love you. And
I love you too, Bonnie.
My bucket list includes seeing you again one more time.
Yes,
you never know when you're going to make it. When you come this way,
yes.
You know, I'm waiting to see you. So all right, everyone, mm-hmm. We'll be back next week, and have a wonderful week, and I love you, Suzette.
Love you too, sweetie.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Goodbye.